On April 11th, 1961, Adolf Eichmann stepped into a glass defendant's box and stood trial in Jerusalem. The trial was broadcast on television with simultaneous translation from Hebrew and German into multiple languages, including English. The proceedings commenced. Presiding Judge Moshe Landau began reading the 15 counts in the indictment against Eichmann.
The accused, together with others, during the period 1939 to 1945, caused the killing of millions of Jews in his capacity as the person responsible for the execution of the Nazi plan for the physical extermination of the Jews, known as the final solution of the Jewish problem.
Adolf Eichmann was a Nazi. He was the architect of the Holocaust. Reading the indictment, Judge Landau named the locations of the Nazis' greatest horrors, the camps that carried out Eichmann's orders.
Auschwitz. Millions of Jews were exterminated in this camp from 1941 until the end of January 1945 in gas chambers and in crematoria and by shooting and hanging. The accused directed the commanders of that camp to use gas known as Cyclone B, and in 1942 and 1944, the accused also secured the supply of a quantity of gas for the extermination of the Jews.
The Adolf Eichmann who stood in the box seemed a passive, even pathetic figure. Thick tortoiseshell glasses, balding, his body, like his hair, receding into a dark, boxy, oversized suit. Even the chief investigating officer at the trial, a Holocaust survivor himself, said that upon first laying eyes on Eichmann, he couldn't believe that, quote, this nerd controlled millions of Jews, their lives, and their deaths. But at trial, Adolf Eichmann refused to accept responsibility for even one of the 6 million lives taken by the Nazis.
Ha'im ata modeh?
Do you admit the first count brought against you?
Oder nicht an dem ersten Anklagepunkt? Im Sinne der Anklage nicht schuldig.
In the spirit of the indictment, I am not guilty.
Reporters from around the world came to cover the Eichmann trial. Among them, Hannah Arendt. The famed writer and political philosopher had been exiled from Europe as a young Jewish girl in World War II. Decades later, she went to Jerusalem to cover Eichmann's trial for The New Yorker. She watched Eichmann for weeks, heard his claims about being nothing more than a little bureaucrat, following the rules of the Nazi state, dutifully enacting the orders of his Nazi commanders. Evil comes from a failure to think, Arendt later wrote, a phenomenon which stared one in the face at the trial. Eichmann was not Iago and not Macbeth, she noted. Except for an extraordinary diligence in looking out for his personal advancement, he had no motives at all. He merely, to put the matter colloquially, never realized what he was doing. It was sheer thoughtlessness. End quote. This, Arendt concluded, was the banality of evil. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 60 years later, the banality of evil has been so oft repeated, it's been reduced to cliche. Just yesterday, a guest on this show used the phrase when trying to explain why so many Republican operatives quickly abandoned their principles in support of the authoritarian slide that led to the Capitol insurrection. So, the banality of evil has become a comforting myth we tell ourselves. Arendt's idea that evil comes from a failure to think is a popular and powerful way to comprehend how anyone could willingly participate in the unthinkable. But in the case of Adolf Eichmann, we now know that Hannah Arendt was wrong. Because Eichmann said so himself.
Mich freut dein, weil ich mir das Innere freut.
This is Adolf Eichmann, his actual voice, speaking in recordings made in Argentina in 1957, 4 years before he went on trial in Jerusalem. And in the recordings, he says, "I regret nothing." "Every fiber in me resists that we did something wrong," Eichmann said in the tapes. "I must tell you honestly, had we killed 10.3 million Jews, then I would be satisfied and say, good, we have exterminated an enemy. That is the truth. Why should I deny it?" Eichmann's evil is not a failure to think. Eichmann's evil is the product of deliberate thinking that made him proud to orchestrate a genocide. So it may be time for us to drop our belief in the banality of evil. Now, the existence of the 1957 Eichmann tapes has been known for some time, but hardly anyone has heard them until now. Those clips you just heard are from a new documentary called The Devil's Confession, The Lost Eichmann Tapes. And its director, Yariv Mosier, joins us now. Yariv, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. It's a big honor to participate in this show. Thank you very much.
Well, I watched the documentary several times, and it left me chilled every single time. I wonder for you, what was your first response or first reaction when you heard the Eichmann tapes for the first time?
First of all, to hear that such a thing exists, that a Nazi allowed himself to talk so freely about what he did, to take responsibility, to brag about what he did during the Holocaust, this was mind-blowing, because all the Nazis after the war, during the Nuremberg trials, for example, they didn't take responsibility. They all said we had to fulfill orders, like Eichmann did in the trial in Jerusalem in 1961. He did the same thing. So to think that there is one Nazi who allowed himself, while being in hiding and feeling protected, this was the thing that drove me so passionately to look for those tapes. And when hearing them for the first time, it was a very moving experience. But, you know, moreover, I was looking to hear in those tapes to feel the authenticity of the sound. So I looked for those sounds that gave me the feeling that this is happening, you know, because we knew that it's happening in a living room. They were drinking wine, lighting cigarettes. The daughter of the journalist was singing from the other room. Hearing those sounds in those tapes gave me the feeling that what I'm hearing is the true thing. And this was,
yes,
this was very powerful.
Yes. So that leads us to the next obvious question, which is these recordings, the Eichmann tapes, were made in 1957, as we noted, and it wasn't until 1960 that Mossad abducted Eichmann from Argentina and took him to Israel for trial. But how is it that 3 years earlier, Adolf Eichmann is sitting in a home in Buenos Aires and making these tapes? Who made them?
Well, this journalist, this Dutch Nazi journalist named Willem Zassen, convinced Eichmann to talk, because he said, well, one day you want your story to be known. You want a book to be published, a biography. No one knew about what Eichmann did. In fact, even Zassen himself and the colleagues, all other Nazi sympathizers who joined them in this living room, didn't really believe the stories of the Holocaust. They thought that these are all Jewish propaganda. They still believed in Hitler, in the Reich, and they couldn't really believe the stories about the scale of the Holocaust. So they wanted in the beginning that Eichmann will say, yes, none of this is true. But on the contrary, Eichmann was sitting there and was looking to get some credit of what will be for him his life achievement, the killing of so many Jews. So he denied those thoughts and said, yes, we did it. We did kill so many Jews, and he talked freely about what he did. And in a way, he was looking to get, you know, recognition for what he did in the war, which is horrifying.
Well, I want to play another moment from the Eichmann tapes that's in your documentary. So this is where Eichmann is sitting again in Sassen's living room, describing how his job was, quote, the physical extermination of the Jews. People in the room are stunned, and Sassen asks him to clarify, and Eichmann does, and here's that moment. So Eichmann here is saying, quote, I didn't even care about the Jews that I deported to Auschwitz. I didn't care if they were alive or already dead. There was an order from the Reichsführer that said Jews who were fit to work were sent to work. Jews who were unfit to work had to be sent to the final solution, period. Sassen then says, and with that you clearly and openly meant physical extermination? And Eichmann responds, if that's what I said, then yes, for sure. Yariv, we only have about 30 seconds before our first break, but in that moment, the tapes reveal that the men in the room themselves were stunned at the truth of what Eichmann was saying, and they actually tried to stop the recording, right?
Yes, because it didn't follow their expectations. They were sure that this is Jewish propaganda, and Eichmann is saying the truth, and that made them, you know, they were shocked, like us.
Well, today we are talking about the Eichmann tapes, the previously unheard 1957 recordings of the architect of the Holocaust, Adolf Eichmann. And the recordings are shared widely and publicly for the first time in the new documentary, The Devil's Confession, The Lost Eichmann Tapes. We'll have much more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're joined by Yariv Mosher. He's an Israeli filmmaker whose latest documentary is called The Devil's Confession, The Lost Eichmann Tapes, in which for the first time, the public, the wide, broad public, gets to hear 1957 recordings made by Adolf Eichmann, the architect of the Holocaust, where he freely, openly, and proudly admits his role in the murder of 6 million Jews. Now, the documentary will be available to American viewers later this year, but right now we have the trailer of The Devil's Confession on our website, onpointradio.org. Now, the big question that we come away with in watching the documentary is, should we collectively, as human beings, drop our belief in the famous phrase coined by Hannah Arendt, the journalist and political philosopher who covered Eichmann's 1961 trial, where she asserted about the banality of evil? Now, the documentary features an interview that Arendt gave after Eichmann's trial, where she talks about what she believes motivated the man.
Dass er besondere Machtgelüste gehabt hat, glaube ich nicht.
Arendt says, I don't think Eichmann had any specific craving for power. He was the typical functionary. And a functionary, if he is really going to be nothing but a functionary, is really a dangerous man. I don't think ideology played a major role. That's Hannah Arendt there speaking. But of course, what we learn in the Eichmann tapes, the 1957 recordings, as revealed in the documentary, is that Eichmann himself explicitly puts Arendt's idea of him as an insignificant bureaucrat to rest. So Eichmann here in Argentina in 1957 is saying, quote, "I, the cautious bureaucrat, that's who I was, yes. To this cautious bureaucrat was added a fanatical fighter for the freedom of my blood lineage, my ancestry. I changed from the once cautious bureaucrat that I was by nature. I was blind, but then came the inspiration that guided me. Whatever is to the benefit of my people is going to be for me holy order and holy law." A translation of the recording that you hear there from 1957. Yariv, may I ask, why is the public, the broad public, hearing these tapes for the first time only now?
Well, for years, it took some time to discover those tapes. It moved from one hand to another. The Nazi journalist Zassin decided eventually to donate them, to give them to the Eichmann family. From what we know, the Eichmann family immediately wanted to make some profit, and they sold it to a publisher in Switzerland who went into bankruptcy, and eventually they moved from one hand to another until discovered in a basement. And this owner, anonymous owner, didn't want to be affiliated with the content of the tapes, so he just placed them for preservation at the German State Archive with instructions not to use them. It could be used for research, so researchers could come to the archive and listen to them, but he didn't allow filmmakers to use the tapes and made them public until I came and started negotiating with this anonymous owner via the German State Archive and convinced him that 60 years to the trial, being on Israeli television, Kan 11, with the support of MGM Studios and Sipur, the Israeli studio, I think it's about time the young audience, the young generation, will hear the truth about what happened and to hear it from a Nazi who takes responsibility for what he did. That will put an end to all Holocaust deniers. They couldn't say anything while hearing him on these tapes. And eventually he agreed to give us full access to the 15 hours of tapes that survived from those conversations.
Hmm. Well, I would like to bring into the conversation one of the researchers who had heard the tapes, the few sets of ears that had heard the tapes before you were able to make them more public in your documentary, Yariv. So joining us now from Hamburg, Germany, is Bettina Stangnied. She's a philosopher and historian and author of the book Eichmann Before Jerusalem, The Unexamined Life of a Mass Murderer. Bettina, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna, and thanks for having me.
So, first of all, I mean, you're a historian of Eichmann, and I just wonder, though, when you first heard these tapes, before the rest of us, what was your response to them? How did you react to hearing them?
I expected that Eichmann would lie, because he's lying all the time, and then I had to be a witness of himself, and I was shocked, too. It was unbelievable that someone is proud about a career as a mass murderer. It's unbelievable.
Because, I mean, we spoke to a German colleague of Yariv's who helped on the film and said similarly for him, it was, as a German, it was a shock because, you know, beyond the film footage of Hitler and his volcanic speeches and what we saw at Nuremberg, for example, I mean, this was the first time that he had heard a Nazi speak with such open pride about what had happened and his role in the Holocaust. Did you feel the same way? That was that what was driving your shock?
Yes, and there's a second thing. It's the sound in this living room. Think about a conference. It's a strange conference because of the subject, but it sounds like a conference, not without gravity, with concentration and passion. The men sitting together there, they're reading discussions, books, papers, own scripts, newspapers too, and they are sitting there with this passion to do something. Don't forget, these men, they were a stopped-out generation. They had power, they had a meaning in history, and they want to rescue National Socialism to do it again. And this conference, this year-long conference, was what they could do at this time in exile. They could meet, talk, work against all the new books. There were only 15 books about the Holocaust at this time, and they read them all.
So this conference, meaning the series of meetings in Sassen's living room, which again, I mean, both you and Yariv are pointing to something which is so unsettling, that this was just happening in a home with children around and other family members. But how does what we hear in the Eichmann tapes contrast with the Eichmann who or how he presented himself in the trial in Jerusalem in 1961.
Eichmann in Buenos Aires was a star of these meetings, of the Sassen Circle meetings. And he was a star again in the trial, but it was a completely different audience. And Eichmann knew it. Eichmann knew all his life that one day the trial will come. And so he decided, okay, I will practice cross-examination. I will practice this situation to explain myself. But in Jerusalem, things were different. He planned to go back to Germany and put himself to trial. That would be an easy thing. But in Jerusalem, he decided to play the bureaucrat for the Jews. He played the cliché he talked about in Buenos Aires. And so he take a big suit, take glasses, take oversized papers and organograms, use long sentences, talk like a bureaucrat, and people will take it. And they take it even today. When you see this tapes, everyone can see this tapes on YouTube from the trial, and you will feel in this trap. And believe that this man is silly. But he played for the Oscar. He was an actor.
Well, so let me play another moment from Yariv's documentary, because he highlights so many critical instances from the 1961 trial. So here's a moment where prosecutor Gideon Hausner asks Eichmann about his decision to murder Jews by gassing them in the concentration camps because using gas was more efficient. Here's that moment. Let's hear it.
Das ist eleganter, aber mit Gas. Bitte meinten die Herren vom Ostministerium, es wird eleganter mit Gas, nicht wahr?
Ja, aber meine Meinung war das ganz bestimmt nicht.
So Gideon Hausner asks Eichmann, it's more elegant to kill with gas. Isn't that what the people from the Eastern Ministry said? Eichmann responds, yes, but that definitely wasn't my opinion. That should be clear from what was said before. I don't know who introduced the physical extermination. Yariv, why did you include moments like this in the film?
You know, it was shocking to go back to the trial, and I was in the notion that Hannah Arendt was right, you know, that somehow Eichmann was maybe a petty bureaucrat, just one who was fulfilling orders, and maybe you can believe what he's saying in the trial. But when you place those moments in the trial against those moments of the tapes, just one places against the other, and you discover clearly that Eichmann is completely lying all the way. I mean, you can't believe any word he's saying anymore, because you hear him 3 years earlier, 4 years earlier, 1957, among his friends, talking with the details and taking responsibility and talking about everything, because he knew everything. And then you hear him in the trial denying. That is, I mean, that is the purpose of what I did. I wanted to put Eichmann, in a way, on trial again. I mean, it wouldn't change the trial, but at least you get to look and hear the true face of this murderer, mass killing murderer. And I'm very honored with Bettina Stangnet participating in my documentary and also in this show. Yeah.
Well, Bettina, let me ask you, how does what the tapes, the 1957 tapes, what they reveal, how does that change, you know, our understanding of men like Eichmann, who, you know, perpetrated this horrific crime against humanity?
Yes, we can learn that two people, two sorts of people are needed. You need the mindless tools Hannah Arendt is talking about. You need the banality of evil. But Eichmann himself knew it. He knew so much how to look like a mindless tool because he used himself so much of them. And this is what Eichmann explained in Buenos Aires, how you organize a state's crime, how you can organize this together, this coordination of so many different people with so many different motives. And of course, you when you are planning a state's crime, you do not have enough people with strong ideology and strong motives. Most people in the world have no normal motives, like a small career, a bit money, and so on. And so you have to use them as tools, and the mindless, the better. But you know, you need someone like Eichmann who understand this this way of acting with the tools.
Yeah. So tell me, we played a moment from the tapes a little earlier where Eichmann does say, yes, I was a cautious bureaucrat. But then he says, I also became a fanatical fighter for the freedom of my blood lineage, my ancestry. He is very open about the fact that ideology is indeed what drove him. When you heard that, what did you think?
Yes, this is true, and this is very clear to understand. For him, it was not enough to be a bureaucrat. It was not sufficient to be only a bureaucrat, to be only a tool. He wanted to understand. He wanted to rule the world. He wanted to be famous, and he wanted to have a special position in history. This is one of the reasons he enjoyed the trial so much, because he was in the center of the world again, and everybody talked about him and wrote books about him. But he himself thought a lot, and he had a special pleasure, and he enjoyed thoughts and thinking, and you can say he thought too much. His ideology was strong, and his arguments firm, and he was able to argue with Spinoza and Nietzsche, and he knew who Martin Heidegger was, and he dealt with all these arguments, and he dealt with Kant, Immanuel Kant, and explained his own morality. And we are sitting here, listen to these tapes, and cannot believe it.
We cannot believe it. Because our minds refuse to hear the truth that is plain to our ears, right? I mean, Yariv, would respond to what Bettina is saying.
I completely agree. This is Eichmann is in a position in which he looks to get some recognition for what he did, and in the trial he enjoys the attention. But he is still, he has the hope that maybe they will spare his life Maybe he will convince that he was not the person that was sitting back in Buenos Aires and talking so proudly of what he did. So in the trial, he takes the complete opposite direction of the same person, but opposite. I just followed orders. I didn't mean to do those things. It didn't work for him because they had enough proofs to show that he knew all the way what he's doing.
Yes, we only have about 30 seconds before our next break. Bettina, Adolf Eichmann convinced himself of the superiority of his performance in the trial, right? He thought he had fooled everyone with his mindless bureaucrat routine, but he didn't. He was found guilty.
Yes, and he was totally shocked. His first sentence after the verdict was, "I didn't think that they would not believe me at all."
Well, we are talking today about what's revealed in the new documentary, The Devil's Confession, The Lost Eichmann Tapes, and whether it's time for us more broadly, the public, to drop our belief in the banality of evil. More in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're talking about what's revealed in the new documentary, The Devil's Confession, The Lost Eichmann Tapes. And in this documentary, the broader public, for the first time, hears recordings made in 1957 in Argentina, recordings made by the Nazi Adolf Eichmann, the architect of the Holocaust, where he proudly, openly admits his role in organizing the murder of 6 million Jews. It's completely different than the persona Eichmann put forward 4 years later when he stood trial in Jerusalem. There, Eichmann portrayed himself as the small and petty bureaucrat, only following orders. Yariv Mosher joins us today from Tel Aviv. He is the filmmaker behind The Devil's Confession. And by the way, it'll be available to American audiences later this year, but we have a link to the trailer on our website, onpointradio.org. Bettina Stangnied also joins us as well from Hamburg, Germany. She's a philosopher and historian and author of Eichmann Before Jerusalem, The Unexamined Life of a Mass Murderer. Now, I want to play another moment from The Devil's Confession, because there's something that I had never, ever known before, Yariv, that you reveal in the film. And it comes via Alan Rosenthal. He's a British-Israeli television producer who was the assistant director of the worldwide broadcast of the Eichmann trial. Now, as such, he spent hours and hours watching Eichmann's manner and his facial expression during the 1961 trial. And in the documentary, he shares a story. Rosenthal shares a story about a moment towards the end of the trial where prosecutor Gideon Hausner decided to show a film reel that was full of footage of the horrors of the death camps. And here's what Alan Rosenthal said happened in the courtroom when that footage was shown.
All the lights were off in the courtroom, and documentary pictures or news pictures were being projected on the wall. Bodies being bulldozed into a death pit. Awful. But we had one camera on Eichmann, and it looked as if he was laughing. As if it was the first time you could see who was Eichmann, what he felt like.
Now, recall, Rosenthal's job as a producer was to constantly look at those camera feeds during the trial. And so the moment he describes, the courtroom itself was dark. So Rosenthal may have been the only person on that video feed, because he saw the video feed. He may have been the only person to see Eichmann smile as these horrific pictures of the death camps were being shown. However, Rosenthal also told us, we followed up with him, that there was plenty of evidence in existence for years that Eichmann was a very different person from the thoughtless bureaucrat described by Hannah Arendt. So when we spoke with Rosenthal just a couple of days ago, he recalled another moment. This one from the 1947 trial in Poland of Auschwitz commander Rudolf Hess.
And he tells the story of Eichmann coming to him in Auschwitz, and he takes him to the gas chamber, and some children are waiting there. And Hess, the head of the concentration camp, doesn't want to put the children into the gas chamber. And Eichmann says, put them in, put the children in, because although they're children now, they are the future generation, they are our future enemies. So come on, Hannah Arendt, to me anyway, makes no sense at all. Her concept of the banality of evil, certainly as it applies to Eichmann, I think was totally, totally wrong.
Bettina, what was Hannah Arendt trying to say when she first presented this idea of the banality of evil?
Hannah Arendt looked at Eichmann and looked on all these documents, and she had the idea that this man has no intention to be evil, that he has only small intentions, small motives, like having a happy life, having his family and a bit of money and a bit of career. And she couldn't find anti-Semitism in his thoughts. She couldn't find ideology. And this is no big wonder. And all journalists in the courtroom, and there were 400 journalists in the room, wrote the same. They wrote, this silly gray man should have done all this. And there's an interesting addition to the story of Rosman. This evening in the court, when Eichmann saw the film, he learned that cameras were there and that he was on film. And he got very, very angry. Why? Because you cannot play a role as an actor when your costume isn't right. And he came to this room to view this film in his casual clothes and not in his suite. And so he was very angry that people could see him as a normal being looking at this film as a normal man.
Mm.
Yes,
mm.
And this does not fit to his actor's role as a stupid man. And do not forget, Magna, Eichmann played this role for people like Hannah Arendt. He knew what they are looking for. He knew that what we as philosophers like to see, or as what journalists are looking for. And he gave a lot of triggers to see this mindless bureaucrat he knew so well. He had a lot of this mindless bureaucrats in his work around him.
Yeah.
So he had only to imitate them. It was very easy, and he was very, very good.
Well, Yariv, let me turn
back to you. And if I may...
Yeah, no, please,
if I may, Magna, just to add, we need to remember that Eichmann was responsible for the death, or you could say that he fooled 2.5 million Jews to their death. He tricked them, he fooled them, he convinced them that they're going, manipulated them to go on his trains and to be sent into death camps. And you think that you see this guy in this big suit and this whole thing and you believe him? This was a guy who was standing in front of Jewish leaders, and they came back home and they said to their families, and this was later noticed and by witnesses and everything, they trusted him. He even says so in the meetings with Zassin, that he convinced them, he talked with them, he used those Jewish leaders to fulfill his role and his mission in order to take so many Jews into trains and to make those small towns clean of Jews. This was his mission. He fulfilled it, and he achieved doing so because he was manipulating those people.
Right. So, okay, so this takes us on a little bit of a tangent, which I'd like to follow just for a moment or two. And then we'll return to this question of the banality of evil. Because the other great revelation for me, Yariv, in your film, is that in a sense, some of Hannah Arendt's broader critiques of the trial itself were probably accurate, because I had no idea that some of what Gideon Hausner presented during the trial may have been softened, for example, in order not to, chill relations between the then young Israeli state and West Germany, because Israel was trying to build the bomb. And that they actually had a transcript of the Eichmann tapes. It had parts of those transcripts had been published in Life magazine, but ultimately it was decided by the judges not to allow the transcript to be entered as evidence into the trial. Can you just talk about some of these like very interesting complexities that your film also reveals, Yariv?
I was trying to ask myself why those tapes were not available to the court in Israel. You know, the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, was so strong, so powerful to go to Argentina and to bring Eichmann. We know today that they were in touch secretly, behind the scenes, with Zassen himself, with the Nazi journalist. So they were trying to make him collaborating with them to find Mengele, another Nazi perpetrator. So I know, and we know, that they could have placed their hands on these tapes, but we asked ourselves why. And we went, unfortunately, the Israeli Secret Service denied giving us access to their archives. But we went to the archives of the CIA and the West German Secret Intelligence Force, the BND, and we found some clues that show the relationship, the secret relationship between David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, who's trying to build the Israeli nuclear weapons plant in the south of Israel. He wanted money, and he could get this money from West Germany, but there was a deal, and the deal was you stop searching for other Nazis because West Germany was filled with them, and they were still in powerful positions, and they were afraid of what Eichmann could say in those tapes and could be revealed in this trial. So they didn't want more trials. They didn't want more names to be mentioned in the Eichmann trial. They didn't want those tapes to be so significant. And this was, this we know from those documents that we revealed, that this was part of the behind-the-scenes negotiations and contacts between Israel and West Germany. So, but it's very important for me to say, I do not criticize David Ben-Gurion. I think that he knew, he looked at the future of Israel and he thought to himself, there is a price that I need to pay now in order to secure my state in the future.
Debating those decisions is for another show at another time, but it was an absolutely fascinating additional part of this history that I had no idea about that was revealed in the film. Now, in the last 5 minutes of our show today, I mean, let's return to the central question that the Eichmann tapes from 1957 reveal. So, Bettina, about Hannah Arendt's thinking regarding the banality of evil, that evil is devoid of thought, essentially. It is the absence of thought which allows the evil to flourish. Was she wrong?
In the case of Eichmann, yes, she was wrong. As a philosopher, she wasn't wrong. For she herself said, the banality of evil is only one sort of evil. There are different reasons for evil doing, and the banality is one of them. People like, in her, to quote her, Himmler and Hitler are different, and Eichmann we have to say today, was different too. So we have to think a bit slower and a bit better, and to say, yes, we need more terms about evil. We need more concepts of evil to understand what people are able to do. And in the case of Eichmann, we can learn and we can listen. And Arif told it very, very good, what a liar and a manipulator can do. Eichmann lied people into their death. He was one of the biggest and most dangerous liars in history. And we can learn to have a bit more respect when we talk about lies and truth. And liars are very, very, very dangerous. And Eichmann is the lesson to learn it.
The power of the popular understanding of the banality of evil, though, that power is great. Because for we in the lay public, outside of academics and historians, it is sometimes very hard to understand. It's impossible to understand how someone could engage in the unthinkable. So it's a convenient and comforting myth, is what I called it earlier, mm-hmm. that it's just this banality of evil. So how would you recommend that the rest of us then evolve our understanding that of how to recognize evil, how evil is nurtured and perpetrated? What should we do to make our understanding more sophisticated?
The theory of the banality of evil is beautiful. It is beautiful because it's the dream that if you bring people to think for themselves, the world will be better. If you bring people to do what they do with thoughts, it could be a better world. And Eichmann is the example that this is not always the truth. Eichmann thought a lot. And if you are thinking a lot and too much, it can be dangerous, it can be evil, it can be a moral problem. So we have to think a bit more about what we want to do together to bring these people who are thinking so much for themselves back into our common world, in a moral world, back to our standards.
Yariv, we have 1 minute left. When American audiences get their opportunity to see this film, and I very much hope they will, what do you want them to take away from The Devil's Confession?
You know, I'm a third generation of Holocaust survivors. I've did this film and TV series in order to bring back the memory of what happened to my grandparents who died. Unfortunately, they didn't... they were not here to see this, but it is important for me to keep the memory still alive. So for us to remember, to know what happened in the Holocaust, so it will not happen again. This is the purpose. This is what led me to do this project. And I'm really hopeful that MGM Studios will be... we'll find the right place for this. And thank you, Meghna, and also Stefano for, bringing the attention to so many people for this project. And eventually it will lead for the right place to show it. And that's the most important thing, for the young generations to be aware of what happened years ago and it will not happen again.
Yes, especially as in the modern world, we're all trying to figure out ways to recognize, you know, whether evil is banal or mindless or not. And if not, what to do about it? Well, Yariv Mosher, filmmaker behind The Devil's Confession, The Lost Eichmann Tapes, thank you so much for joining us today. And Bettina Stangnied, philosopher and historian and author of Eichmann Before Jerusalem, The Unexamined Life of a Mass Murderer. Thank you, Bettina, as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.